If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. This is the story of how one of the most influential worship bands was born, and how another one of the biggest worship bands got together to dominate the modern worship scene, and how one guitar player was in the middle of both of those bands. This is a story of following a dream, keeping that dream alive, and following it wherever it leads next. This is the story of Stu G and his amazing journey from Delirious to One Sonic Society, and it's one of my favorite conversations yet. Now, before we get to Stu, I want to remind you that new episodes release every Monday, but if you'd like to get early access to future shows, consider becoming a premium subscriber and get fun extras for helping support what we're doing with this podcast. Just follow the link in the episode description for super easy subscriber setup. Also, would you please take time to leave a 5-star rating, which many of you have, and I really appreciate it. And leave us a review and tell your friends about One Degree. This will help us reach a wider audience. And it'll help the algorithms, which is a real thing. I'm learning about those. It makes us easier to find. And sometime this week, head over to my website, andychristman.com, to see where I'll be singing each month. I'll have my schedule up there, how you can support the ministries I'm a part of, and sign up for my newsletter. That way you don't miss out on anything. Now, here's my conversation with Stu G. I became a worship pastor full-time in 2000. And it's really been one of the joys of my life to make that transition from being a full-time artist to being a full-time pastor, and then trying to figure out how those two come together. But that's not really what this story is about. I just kind of wanted to set our conversation up by saying, if it wasn't for Delirious, I don't know where worship music would be today. I mean, you guys really blazed that path and blazed that trail for guys like me who were looking for songs to sing that were, you know, were congregational, were moving, but were also, you know, still sounded like great music. And I, for one, am grateful for Delirious. And today, my special guest is one of the guys that was an original member of that band and part of some of those great songs during the day. And you're also a member of one of my other favorite worship bands, One Sonic Society, which is just, I think, was a transformative group of guys coming together. I love Jason and what he's been able to do in worship. But I'm really excited to talk to you for the first time.
Yeah.
And I feel like I know you because I know your music and I know your history in Christian music. You're a legend in Nashville. And
thank you.
Welcome to the One Degree of Andy podcast.
Thanks, Andy.
My new friend, Stu G.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's great to be here and have a good chat, see what you're up to. It's
awesome. Yeah, thank you. So, let's go back to your Delirious days. That's where I want to start because that's, you know, that's where I first heard your name and where, you know, I began to hear your music and, you know, Martin, of course, just is this figure that, you know, those of us as worship leaders look to and just go, that guy was just really, you know, was on another level before any of it and the rest of us were.
Right.
Take me down through that journey of starting Delirious and how all of that happened.
Yeah. So I might have to go back just a tad further. So my wife and I, we were born in Ipswich, Suffolk, on the east coast of England, and I left school and was a electrician. So I did apprenticeship and did all that. One day I walked into a record store called Parrot Records in Ipswich, and I had been with my first kind of wages from being an electrician. I got up to date with the Queen record catalog.
Oh, wow. Right? My son is a massive Queen fan. That's like his favorite band of all time.
So this was like 1978, 1979, right? And so they had nine records up to date and what have you. So I, I was kind of, you know, getting that. I was a huge Queen fan. And then one day I went in the record store and the guy says, hey, there's a new Queen album out. Do you want to hear it? So he put it on the turntable for me. I had the headphones on. And it was Queen Live Killers, the live record. And the first track on that is like a fast version of We Will Rock. It's like a rock and roll version of it, yeah. Right? And as soon as I heard the opening bars of that song, I was like, I want to be Brian. Like, this is what I want to do. And I didn't play guitar at the
really?
Time. Really? Yeah.
Not at all. Were you a musician at all?
I was 16, 17. So I'd wanted to learn drums.
Uh-huh.
So my mum and dad, they actually bought me a drum kit when I was like 12 or 13. And I had lessons from the guy that they bought it from. So I was learning to play drums and then had this complete running into a brick wall moment of like, you know, Brian May and yeah. Queen and want to do that. So we sold my drum kit. My dad took me up to this little music store called Whitmore's Music on in the Norwich Road at Ipswich. And bought a guitar and a practice amp and that was it. You know, I was like in my bedroom learning Queen songs. And then they paid for me to have tuition for like 18 months with this little private yeah. tutor. And
did you take to it right started. Away? I mean, was it just kind of a natural thing to pick
yeah,
up the guitar?
It was very natural. I learned from playing by ear, really.
Uh-huh.
And even when my teacher, my first teacher, he was teaching me to read. Well, but what I would do every week is I would watch him play the piece and listen to it and then go home and just practice it from memory and like just grind it in like that. And then, so he eventually caught me out. We were doing a tune called The Deer Hunter, which is a classical piece. And it's the theme from the, it's called Cavatine. It's the theme from The Deer
Hunter. The Deer Hunter, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was like, he thought something was up and he was starting to turn the pages in the wrong place. And I kept playing it perfectly. So
prodigy.
Yeah, he said, oh, I don't think I can teach you anymore. You know, that was it. I got fired. anyway, that was the beginning. So what happened is that through my brother-in-law, I became a fan of Phil Keaggy. So I'd grown up in the church, but wasn't really following Jesus. Karen, my wife, had no kind of, their family was kind of, you know, went to church at Christmas or weddings, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'd kind of grown up in it, but wasn't really following.
How did you discover Phil's music?
Through my brother-in-law. So,
oh, okay.
So Alan, he gave me a record or lent me a record, Good Town to Town.
Uh-huh.
And, became a massive fan of Phil Keaggy through his guitar playing. And so, 1983, Karen and I, we got married in 84. So we were engaged at the time, heard that there was a Phil Keaggy concert in London. And so we went, we wanted to go and see it. So we went to the concert at the same time. We had, relatives that had a church in London. And, we went to stay with them. Like they always, like when they came to Ipswich to visit, they would always say, oh, come and visit in London. So, we went for the weekend in London, stayed with our friends and went to the concert. Well, two things collided. Like one was like, we were totally suckered by the Phil Keaggy concert because there was an evangelist there. And then, secondly, we'd never experienced anything like the church environment that was in London that we visited. You know, it was kind of like based in homes. It's like everyone lived within a square mile of each other. It's very community based. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of like the black sheep of the family because they, you know, raised their hands and spoke in tongues. So it's like, but we've never experienced yeah. anything like that. My yeah. wife and I. So like,
what year really is this again? What year is this
83,
again? 83. Yeah, I kind of had the same, just in the States, I grew yeah. up in a very conservative Christian home, yeah. Southern Baptist, down in Texas. And then I went to my brother's church
yeah.
in Oklahoma, and we called them Happy Baptists.
Yeah.
And they actually got kicked out of the Southern Baptist Convention because they lifted their hands and
yeah.
spoke in tongues and uh-huh. and danced,
yeah.
you know, during the worship service. And yeah. it was a, it was at first frightening to me.
Yeah.
But then once I got to know everybody there, I was like, this is,
yeah,
like, this is what I'm born for. Like, this is what I want, yeah, to be a part of.
Yeah.
You felt that way when you
definitely felt similar. Like, first of all, it like was
both
like
those emotions of like, I don't know what this is, and yeah, there's something I really like about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the feeling of like, wow, like, this really feels genuine and real.
Yeah.
Like, and I had no idea that God was interested in me right now, like this.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, mm-hmm, in terms of, you know, hearing a little word from God or something, you know, like,
yeah.
So anyway, we, both my wife and I, really committed our lives to Jesus that weekend. And and so it wasn't long before the pastor of this church, like, we started like a little house group in Ipswich with, yeah, my mum and dad, and they used to come down and visit and kind of help lead this, and that grew into a little church. And at the same time, he was kind of seeing in me and in Karen like that there's something on these two, but with music, you know, stuff. So they invited us to go and live with them in London, yeah, in community with them. And like, the idea was that we'd travel with them as the pastor, you know, and like, I'd learn how to lead worship and play music and stuff like that. Anyway, so there was like five churches within this little network. And that's what we did. We lived with them in community, traveled with them, and including one year in Belgium where we helped plant a church in Belgium.
Oh, wow.
And what have you. And then, and I ended up like starting a band called the Stuart David Band. And we, there was a 3-piece, and we used to play the rock clubs in London, Marquee and Mean Fiddler, Rock Garden, places like that. And they loved it because we had a little audience that would always come follow us from the church, yeah, you know, and what have you. So that was awesome. And then that the Stuart David Band turned into a band called the Treasure Park, where we added a keyboard player and another singer, and then we started to like do the bigger circuit. Like, we were doing the stuff in London at the, mm-hmm, rock clubs, but we'd also get to play Greenbelt Festival, which was a Christian, oh, wow, arts festival in the UK.
And what was your style of music like? What, like, where were you taking your inspiration from?
Well, I mean, it was kind of, I mean, it was mid-80s, so it was kind of Dan Reed Network, if you remember them. Like, we were big fans of Dan Reed Network, and so it was kind of, you know, it was rock and roll, and you know, I was into Phil Keaggy, so it's a little, yeah, bit intricate at the same time.
Yeah,
you know, it was that kind of stuff, really. I mean, I was a huge Queen fan, I was a huge Rush fan, The Police, U2, you know, all of that, yeah, was all happening at the same time. So, yeah, it just got mismatched into that kind of thing. Yeah, so like, it, like, fast forward to the early 90s, like 90 to 92, I was kind of like doing this band, and then that disbanded. Karen and I moved to a church in the Midlands, in East Midlands, that was part of this network, but then I became like director of worship for like 3 congregations there. So I was basically a worship,
oh, wow,
pastor.
That's really cool. So you were able to do this full time. You didn't,
yeah,
well, you weren't having to sub as an electrician to pay the bills or anything.
No,
you were able,
no,
to.
No, I actually left being an electrician in 1986. And then, yeah, from like then onwards, we apart from a bit that I'll get to in a minute, but
yeah,
we, when we moved to Kettering in the East Midlands after being in London, in London, we lived in community. So it was like shared, mm-hmm, purse, really, with,
oh,
our,
wow,
pastor and his wife, and,
yeah, wow,
and another family. But then when we moved to Kettering in the East Midlands, and you know, I had a job with the church at that point, and I was paid, you know, to do that. But they gave me freedom to play with other people. So there's a UK worship leader called Noel Richards.
Mm-hmm.
I got to like know him and tour with him. There was a reggae artist called Ben Okafor, and I toured with him. And then one of the key things in the whole Delirious story was there was a worship leader from, well, at the time, from the Anaheim Vineyard. He'd come from Kansas City before that, but and his name was Kevin Prosh, and he had made an album called Even So Come with the Vineyard, or So Come, and that completely floored me. It was really amazing, and for whatever reason, he was coming to the UK somehow through friends or whatever. Contacted me, will I play guitar on his tour in the UK? I was like, yeah. Do you want to, you know, at the church here, I've got a van as well.
He's like, perfect, you're hired.
So yeah, I was right. Yeah, so we, you know, I ended up driving around as well. But that the time with Kevin, so like, he was a musician's musician.
Yeah,
you know, it was all about tone, and he was an incredible musician, and he was really encouraging the folks in the UK like myself. And like, you know, Martin and the others, you know, to really explore the music that you love.
Yeah.
And use that as worship.
Yeah, that's one thing that really stood out to me about Delirious was the soundscape. It was,
yeah.
It wasn't, you know, because most bands, and especially church bands, were just going to play whatever came out of their instruments. But just the guitar tones and the drum sounds and just everything that you wrapped around the song. It was, I have a really good friend of mine that always say the sound is the song. And that's something I always, when I listen back to Delirious, I think about Delirious music. I think about the sound as well as the emotion and the lyrical content. You created a sound that was very right. unique. And I love that.
So I was on tour with Kevin, and Noel Richards, who I'd mentioned earlier, he had a forum for worship leaders and musicians that I used to be a part of as well. And I'd drive down to London from Kettering, the East Midlands, to be a part of that. And, you know, apart from meeting Martin and Tim was the keyboard player in Delirious, apart from meeting them like at Spring Harvest or something, you know, that when they'd come to see my band play, you know, they were also part of this, forum. And so, you know, we kind of became acquaintances at that.
Yeah.
At the same time, I was friends with a man called Andy Piercy. Andy Piercy used to be in a band called After the Fire. They had a big hit in America, actually, with
The
Commissar.
The Commissar, yeah.
Yeah. And he was helping me, like, with my band. Like, he was helping produce, like, a live experience with my band. And then, but he was also Martin and Tim and Stu, the drummer, they had just started this youth worship event called Cutting Edge in Littlehampton in a school drama hall with 70 kids. And Martin had written like 5 songs or something, and they were just going to make their first cassette EP, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they invited me to play on it, and I couldn't do it because we'd got a family holiday plan, and it was going to be our first holiday for, like, you know, since we'd moved to London or something, you know, so couldn't do it anyway. But the connection stayed fresh, and they said, you know, will you come down and play one day? And so I went down to Littlehampton one Sunday night at this youth event, Cutting Edge, and just absolutely loved it. I mean, loved the environment, loved the church, loved how it felt. And there was something about it that was like something bubbling away here, you know. And so went home, took Karen down the next time, and our little 18-month-old daughter. And we just loved it. And we fell in love with the place and ended up like feeling like we need to move down. And this feels like the right place for our family. And so we moved down to Littlehampton.
Kids, how many kids did you have this time?
We had one daughter, and at the time that we moved, Karen was 6 months pregnant with us,
wow,
with our second daughter. So we moved down, and when I went down there, I had like a week's worth of work. You know, I had, because I was leaving a job, right?
Yeah.
And I had a couple of sessions on the South Coast, mm-hmm, to play on. And so I went back to being an electrician, like just went self-employed for what turned out to be 2 or 3 years, actually, because didn't see it as a sacrifice. It's just like, we have to be there.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you do whatever you have to for your family.
That's
don't
right.
You? So we did that. And then so the cutting edge stuff was all happening, and we were making records, you know, those six song EPs or whatever. And they were all cassettes at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really realize that we were starting a record label. It was, all we were doing was making, you know, 250 cassettes, selling them at the back of the hall, you know?
Yeah.
And, but whenever anyone said, oh, we can help you with that, you know, and then when you get the numbers through, it's like, yeah, you can make 50p a cassette or something, when we were making like £4, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not even a conversation, you know? So we just kept everything ourselves and ended up starting a company called Furious Records. And the Furious had a question mark on it, only because you know, we like to tell the story that, you know, that companies were angry because we didn't sign with them. I mean, that's not really the case, but that, you know.
So that's where that came from. You know, obviously you get asked this question probably daily. Why the question mark on the end of Delirious? Or,
right,
you know, because it, you know, it does create a conversation of, how are we supposed to pronunciate this? You know, what's going on?
No, that's right. Well, the question mark really came from the, there was a publishing company. We owned a publishing company called Furious. And I think that was the first thing. And we put the question mark on it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Because Curious, you know?
Yeah.
And then Furious Records. And we ended up, you know, keeping the question mark on
that. Yeah.
And then when we eventually decided, so Martin had a car crash in August of, I'm trying to think of the year, 95 probably. And, you know, he could have died in it. He got a bit mangled up and was in hospital for a while. And, you know, I used to go and visit him most days. And in hospital, he was reading a book called U2 at the End of the World by Bill Flanagan, who traveled with them through the whole zoo tour,
uh-huh.
There's Europa and stuff like that. And fantastic book for anyone that's a musician or in a band. They should read that book. It's really inspiring. And so Martin was like, I feel like I've been given a second chance. And, you know, at this time we'd been getting loads of invitations to go and lead worship and play in around the country of England and the UK actually. And it was getting very busy. You know, we all had jobs and we were trying to, like, you know, make things work. And and so Martin was like, you know, I want to do this full time. You know, are you in, sort of thing? And I was like, yes, straight away. But it took a little while for everyone to sort of, you know, figure out the businesses and,
right,
you know, all the stuff they were doing.
Yeah.
So we eventually turned full time in on April 1st of 96. And, you know, we'd been going 4 years at this point with the cutting edge stuff. But we wanted to give it an official kind of title. And that's, you know, we had Curious and Furious. And so we were all really excited about being Delirious, you know, we were Delirious about becoming a band. And so that was the name that kind of stuck with the, and we just kept the question mark. I mean, people were kind of like saying about us, are they a rock band or a worship band? Like, what are they? You know, because, and of course the answer was yes, you know.
Uh-huh. Right, it, right. That's the best kind. That's, you know, I always looked for bands and artists that you couldn't really pigeonhole. And, you know, just say, well, they're this or this. You were always doing something that was interesting. And that's,
And that really comes from not having a label in some respect.
Yeah.
And not having someone, you know, kind of keeping us in a box, if you know what I mean. You know, I mean, we were a nightmare for people that wanted to market us, honestly. Or
can see that.
We were a nightmare for promoters because, you know, we didn't want to be away from home more than 10 days at a time. And, you know, we had to turn down some massive opportunities because of that. And,
I know you didn't. I never saw you guys in the States that much.
We were here a lot, actually. We used to, like, sort of 50 to 55 dates in America a year.
Okay.
And that over Easter, we would come for 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
but bring the family. So, we'd have 3 tour buses out on the road and, not make any money, but hopefully not lose too much, you know?
Yeah.
And it kept the families engaged in what we were doing. It was really an adventure for the kids as well. So, yeah, that was that. I mean, we had an incredible run. You know, so in America, if, you know, the name Delirious comes up, it comes up as like, you know, worship music and I Could Sing Your Love Forever mm-hmm. and Did You Feel the Mountains Tremble and Rain Down, Majesty,
yeah.
You know, like stuff like that. And that is all amazing and brilliant. In the rest of the world, we had a slightly different career because we had songs in the charts in the UK. They were the same songs, you know, that were on all our records. But, you know, songs like See the Star or It's Okay. And we got to tour with some amazing bands like Bon Jovi.
Wow.
We did a stadium tour with Bon Jovi in 2001 and Bryan Adams we toured with in the UK, Matchbox 20.
So what do they think about your message? I mean, because obviously at this point in your careers, I mean, you're full on like living your faith out. This isn't just something you've jumped into as new Christians or anything.
Yeah.
So what was that like? What was that like being a like really... like solid Christians going out with these non-Christian bands.
Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways, like I personally look back on those times and feel like, oh, I never felt so alive, like in places where you feel like, oh, this, I'm supposed to be doing this.
Yeah.
You know, like that was amazing. And to see, you know, a stadium crowd that have come to see Bon Jovi, with their hands in the air to History Maker and My Glorious and stuff like that, because to them it was just great music. But it always felt like, oh, there's something else connecting here, mm-hmm. you know, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, you're planting seeds.
Yeah.
You know,
it was really cool. And then, you know, I mean, as with any band, right, so you always want to, like, if you talk to any band, you hear the same conversations. Oh, we want to do something. We just want to do the real thing. Like this, we want to do something really authentic. And there's always a thing of like if we had a hit on radio or I don't mean Christian radio. I mean like
right.
You know,
these are all markers whatever. Of success
and
an artist.
It can become a little bit of an idol to kind of chase after in some ways. But you know, we had an element. And a good amount of that kind of living in that sort of space. We had 5 top 20s in the UK.
Wow.
On mainstream radio and we had a number 2 at radio in Germany. You know, it was super cool. And, you know, we got to play Glastonbury Festival and some big rock festivals in Europe and Eastern Europe. And it was just really, really super cool. And
it made you keep your game strong too as a musician.
Yeah,
because you could come to the States and just do Christian shows and be around Christian bands. And I mean, I was in a Christian band, so I'm not running down Christian musicians, but there are levels of, you know, if you're really great, like you think about we were talking about Dan Huff in one of our other conversations that, you know, a guy like that's not just going to stay in the Christian music field. Yeah. He's going to start there, but then is going to go on and play for the biggest bands and produce the biggest bands in the world. Mm-hmm. So I would think being around and touring with big pop and rock bands, it would cause you to step up another level musically.
Totally. I remember one gig we did in New York. We did a gig with Muse.
And
with
one of my favorite bands,
a band called Feeder from the UK.
Uh-huh.
And, I remember, you know, our lighting guy, one of my best friends to this day, he came out to the bus, says, "Stu, get in here quick." And we watched Muse play, and it was like so inspiring. I mean, this is like probably their first album.
You know, yeah.
It was around 2000, I think.
Uh-huh.
But yes, I mean, you've got, if you want to live in that world, you've got to be as good as everyone else, you know?
Yeah.
So we, you know, we tried to do that. And, but at the same time, we loved playing churches in America and theaters in America. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I remember our very first tour or our very first dates in America were in California in 96. We all had roles to play within the band, right? All had like day jobs, if you like. So yeah. At the time, mine was international tour manager as well as songwriter and guitar yeah. player, right? So yeah. I kind of organized this thing that was like a little bit of a disaster in the moment, but
you're going to get blamed for a lot of stuff.
Turned out to be an amazing thing. So we had connections with the Anaheim, with the Vineyard Church in California, uh-huh. and they invited us out to this worship conference in San Luis Obispo that not many people turned up to. That was the thing that not great, but that we absolutely loved our time there. And we went down, we did the youth service at Anaheim on the Saturday night and then led worship at Anaheim on Sunday. And because the conference up in San Luis Obispo wasn't well attended, we had all this merch with us. We had all these sets and all this product.
Yeah.
And we didn't really want to take it back. So right. we did a deal with the shop at the Anaheim Vineyard in, the main Vineyard Church. And they had a store and we kind of like did a deal with them. They took all our product, ended up selling out.
Wow.
And to this day, if Delirious did, you know, if we ever did a reunion or something and played in California, especially Southern California, that would be a real hotbed of support to this day.
Wow.
You know? I remember we did the Bren Event Center, sold out 4,000 people. You know, I mean, it's pretty amazing at the time.
So when did Delirious start to wind down and you made your way here full time?
Yeah. So we had a like 17-year run. We actually finished in 2009. So we knew a year before that we were going to like wind down.
What were the reasons for that? You just felt like you'd done what you were set out to do, or
no? I mean, it was different for everybody. Uh-huh. But it was Martin that kind of came to us on tour one day and said, you know, I think he's got 6 children, and 5 or 6 anyway. And he was like, oh, I just can't keep this pace up. I feel like I want to leave the band, you know, like spend more time at home.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us knew really how to do that. You know, do we carry on, find a new lead singer, or is that weird? And we ended up, yeah, that's too strange to...
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, it was such a thing of the five of us, you know. And...
that's what we did with For Him. I mean, we made a decision that if one of us left the group, we weren't going to try and replace that person because our sound was so unique.
Right.
And we just didn't want to see 5 different versions over 30 years of For Him. We wanted to, you know, if it was all 4 of us, it was none of us. So the same kind of thing happened to us. You know, I was kind of the first one in to go, man, my kids are about to become teenagers and I don't want to miss those teenage years. And, you know, the work we're putting into this is taken away from my time at home. And all the guys eventually were kind of nodding their heads going, we're feeling the same thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think for us, you know, we weren't all feeling the same thing, but, you know, we got to a place, the only thing being that it was a big machine.
Yeah.
You know, so, like with the record company, distribution company, publishing.
Hmm. Because you started all of that. That was all in-house.
Yeah. And we had, you know, we had a staff, like including us, there was like 13 people working for us.
So did you have any other artists on your label and through your publishing?
We did. It was more distribution. Like we distributed a lot of, folks from America into the rest of the world.
Oh,
so
wow.
Like we had, I think we were distributing into 95 territories around the world or something. And
so if Delirious disbanded, that means
the
whole thing's gone.
Yes. Yeah. And so we had to, so, you know, the two people that were running these things with us, Tony Pitotto was our manager and a co-owner actually. And then You know, he's now running Field Music Management in Tennessee here. And then Jonathan Brown was running our distribution company, and he's now CEO of Integrity Music.
Oh, wow.
So, you know,
yeah.
Our companies all kind of like did stuff elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, they were all sold off or taken over, whatever.
So then was it a natural decision for you to bring your family to Nashville?
It wasn't natural at first, but in the last year of touring, whenever we came to America, whenever Delirious came to America, I always used to tag on a few days. I'd spend some time in California and some time in Nashville multiple times that year, just to stay connected with people. You know, I didn't know if I didn't want it to be finished in terms of, you know, me and music, and didn't want to hang my guitar up, you know. And so it was literally that there's not a whole lot going on in Christian music in the UK, or there wasn't at the time. And, you know, I wasn't the lead singer. And so I kind of dove into opportunities to songwrite here and in opportunities to play on people's records. And over from 2008 onwards, and then early 2010s, my work started to come from, like, more of my work started to come from here.
Yeah. Who were some of the first people that you fell in with that kind of became friends of yours here and were giving you work and inviting you in on projects?
Yeah. So in terms of becoming friends, it were Jimmy Abeg.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy and Michelle were like super kind to us, and Jimmy's been such a mentor for me over the years. And like a sage almost, you know. And so, you know, I got to know Jimmy like before, or I met Jimmy before Delirious, like when he was with the Charlie Peacock Trio. And around 1990, I first met him. But anyway, so he's such a strong friend to this day. We would often dream up a load of stuff. Pretty soon after I started to come here, I met Jason Ingram, and Jason introduced me to Holly Zabka at Essential.
Yeah.
In fact, Essential Worship or Essential Publishing had just started.
Yeah. Holly just took over at Provident.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. She's had a hand in so many great careers.
Yeah.
So I will tell you, the first time I met Jason, I did a solo album in 2004,
okay,
and I tried my hand at writing the whole record, and
yeah,
it was a really fun experience. And I got put in a room. Word was you know, courting me, and you know, with publishing and signing an album deal. And so they put me in a room with a young Matthew West and Jason Ingram.
Mm.
And I had specifically asked for Jason because I had heard some of his solo stuff, and I was like, I really like where this guy is. Whereas, like, And we sat and wrote before he wrote any of his really big songs.
Yeah.
We sat in a room and wrote, and I just remember thinking, these two guys, like, first of all, I couldn't keep up with Matthew.
Yeah.
Matthew was just this stream of consciousness. And I'm like, I can't write fast enough. I've got to get a recorder on him. And then Jason would just come in with these lines. We're just like, where did you get that? Like,
yeah.
That's you're a poet, man. Like,
yeah.
I don't, and it was so deep and beautiful.
Yeah.
And yeah. So then it's excited me when,
too,
you know, when he really started making a lot of worship music.
Yeah. 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 Incredible. So, he introduced me to Holly Zabka, and I ended up, long story short, with a publishing deal here. And, so that was cool. So I'd arranged to come over for a week at a time, whatever. And
yeah,
like write songs with people. And, you know, then I remember Peter Furler reaching out. It was like, you play on, you know, this latest Newsboys album or whatever it was. And, you know, and then, so I'd been in a studio with, his name is eluding me right now, but, Joe someone.
I can't help you on that one.
Yeah. So, and, you know, little by little, just started to get a little bit more of that and a little bit more of the writing. Yeah. The writing thing was, a shock to the system, because writing in Delirious, it was mainly me and Martin, and we would, you know, collect all our ideas and notebooks and work tapes throughout the year, and then get together at the end of each year and hammer out some things and ideas and like really firm this stuff up, and then take it to the other guys in January, February, and we'd record in February, March, that kind of thing. That was typically how it was. And then coming to Nashville and having, you know, a 9 till 1 and a 2 till 6 every day with different people. I remember the first time I did that, and getting to Wednesday, waking up thinking like, I am completely dry.
Yeah.
The well's gone. You know, I've got nothing left.
I've used up all my ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know what that feels like.
And it was such a shock. Anyway, it wasn't long before, work started to come from here more than it was from the UK. And it was Easter of 2010, and I'd brought my wife and our two girls over to visit Nashville. You know, is this a place where we need to have a base? Because I was like either on Jimmy's couch or in Jason's spare room, you know, and it's like I didn't want to, you know, keep being a burden. I mean, I wasn't a burden to them, but you know what it's like. You start to feel stuff like that.
Yep.
So, you know, do we have a base? Do we rent an apartment or a flat or something like that? And so we came over to have a look around. We were here, supposed to be here for a week, and then the volcano erupted in Iceland that spewed all that stuff into the air, and it shut down all transatlantic traffic. So we couldn't get home. So we were here for an extra week. And while we were here that second week, we ended up buying a house because it ended up making more sense.
Yeah.
And so we bought a house in Franklin here. And obviously the property market was a very different beast.
Oh my gosh.
13 years ago.
you still have that house?
No, we sold that and got a different one. But
yeah. Well, anybody that's held on to real estate here for more than 10, 20 years is just looking at a gold mine.
Yeah. No, that's true. So,
when did you, I want to know, let's get to One Sonic Society, just because I'm a huge fan of that band and how that formed and when you guys decided that was something that was going to be something you wanted to be a part of and was something special.
Yeah. I mean, so Jason, I remember sitting, we were having dinner with Jason and Paul Mabry. Funnily enough, Paul had been in a band in Perth, Australia, and they'd supported Delirious back in the day. So, like, totally remembered who Paul was.
Yeah.
And obviously, Jason was already becoming a legend, you know, in the scene here. And it was just it's kind of an honor to be in the conversation with him. And the idea was, you know, there's three of us, four at the time. John from Delirious was also a part of it right at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And it's like got this collection of people who are, you know, busy doing stuff and then coming together to kind of like, this is our expression of, you know, creative worship, that kind of sort of idea. And yeah, really proud of those records that we made. In the end, it was just me and Paul and Jason, and and their careers have just skyrocketed.
Oh my gosh! I mean, talk about packing out that CCLI top 100.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy.
Just how many songs are on that?
Yeah,
from you guys.
Yeah, I know. So that's so good, and you know, we were, so Jason and Paul, you know, they were obviously kind of really busy, like building their producing and writing thing. And, One Sonic we'd be doing, you know, maybe one thing a month or, you know, it's kind of, pretty rare to get out. And I had the opportunity to play with Michael W. Smith, who's another name in my story. I did my first tour with Michael in 2010, and then I did the Two Friends tour in 2011 with him and Amy, and it was incredible. I loved doing that. Talking about Dan Huff, you know,
yeah,
I have to practice those solos to Place in This World and Secret Ambition. You know, when we're on tour, I'm in the hotel room practicing them every day. But so, you know, he was offering me to be a kind of a full time member of his touring entourage. I mean, not full time in terms of being on salary, but just, you know, every time I play with a band, will you come out? So I stepped aside a little bit from the One Sonic thing in 2015 because I also wanted to, make a project based on the Beatitudes forever, you know, for 15 years at that point, you know, and in talking with Jason and Paul, they were just massive like supporters of it, but it just meant that I had to step aside, like run alongside the One Sonic thing and you know, use my time with Michael to kind of, you know, pay some bills and do that. So we haven't done that much together, Jason and Paul and I, for 5 years. I mean, they have released things as One Sonic Society, but I haven't been a part of that. But, you know, we're still best buddies. I think I'm still on the legal documents. I don't know. But, you know, hoping that we'll kind of circle back on some stuff together soon. And but they're good. They're really good friends. I'm so proud of them in terms of what they've done and what they've been able to achieve. Like, massive fans of what they're doing.
And so the Beatitudes, is that available now? Are you finished with it?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, the record, so it initially it got released in 2017, film came out in 2018. So the it's an album of songs with some amazing collaborations, like Michael and Amy's on there, John Mark McMillan, Matt Maher, Martin Smith, Amanda Cook, Propaganda. There's tons of people on there. Hillsong United. I didn't realize, like, everyone was so kind in their support and giving me their time and their, you know, writing songs with me for this record. But it made a little rod for my back in terms of actually trying to promote it afterwards, because I couldn't do a concert and get everyone to come, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't just about music anyway, but that was a little bit difficult. I wrote a book, that got published by NAV Press called Words from the Hill. And really if there's one big idea around the project, you know, the Beatitudes, they all start with blessed are, right? Mm-hmm. So we look at what blessing is, and, I guess if there's one big idea from it, it's that the blessing is presence. Like you know, God doesn't give us a quick fix or a ladder out of our situations that perhaps where we're poor in spirit or where we're experiencing grief or where there's a lack and we're hungry and thirsty for righteousness, right? Like he doesn't say, here's a quick fix out of it. It's like, I'm with you. And so the blessing is the blessing is present, but also the invitation is present. Like it's the invitation in the Beatitudes is for me to be present to my own poverty of spirit and then, the poverty of spirit of others.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and in doing so, we become bearers of the presence, the divine presence. Right. So, that's kind of like the big idea around it. And I started to meet folks who, embodied something of each Beatitude. So, for instance, Al Andrews, who has something called Porter's Call.
Yeah.
You know, counseling service for artists and musicians.
Oh, man.
Songwriters.
How many times? His name has come up a lot, too.
Yeah.
All the artists that we've talked to.
Yeah.
Yeah, Al's a big fan. Yeah. Thank God for him.
Exactly.
And, yeah, what like he's been able to do for artists and in Christian music.
After Delirious finished, I saw him for about 3 years.
Wow.
You know, just trying to untangle things and get things right in the back, in the correct perspective and all that. But he introduced me to a lady who'd been on death row for 27 years and had her sentence commuted by Governor Bredesen 3 years ago to life sentence with the possibility of parole. And then ended up getting parole. And So we had the conversation around, like, what does mercy look like? What does blessed are the merciful look like to you? And actually had lunch with her and with Amy Grant. And then Amy and I wrote a song called Morning Light, which is the Blessed Are the Merciful song, right? So also with, she was connected with, so Gail, the woman that was on death row, was connected with Thistle Farms, Becca Stevens' organization in Nashville. And so I got to speak to some of the women there, survivors of prostitution, addiction, trafficking, and got to talk to them about mercy, you know, and what does that look like? So it's kind of like that all the way through. I'd find a story or someone to kind of pin a chapter around,
right,
you know,
right?
And then it became a film, and then along with the film, I wrote a like a handbook, like a study type guide with some prayers in, and you know, some daily meditation type stuff. For a couple of years, I'd get out to a bunch of churches, and you know, someone would be doing a series on the Sermon on the Mount, and you know, to kick it off, we'd do the Beatitudes, and I'd, you know, do a little talk in their church, and then show the film in the afternoon or something like that. You know, absolutely loved doing that. And then COVID happened, and so that all went away.
Yeah.
And like, I felt, oh no, we've lost so much momentum. And and I was at a songwriter's retreat, and I was chatting with someone, and they said, hey, you know, you should like put this all into an online e-course. And so some friends in the UK helped me put this all together. We've got it into chapters and like a 10-week little study.
Yeah.
E-course. And so it's all up online right now, TheBeatitudesProject.com. And you know, it's book, album, art, film, study materials, it's all up there. And I'd love to kind of invigorate or reinvigorate that people's attention on it. I'm still really passionate about it, and I think it's something that has the potential to change lives. Like, I did every now and then we'll do a webinar and like get a guest on and stuff like that. And I remember we had this pastor called Brian Zahn on, and he, I was asking him about prayer and the Beatitudes. And, you know, he was saying that he literally prays the Beatitudes every day, kind of as they are, as part of his kind of prayer
practice. It's a great idea.
And because in his words, he says that he wants to have that posture throughout the day. You know, it's kind of an upside down thing. It's very subversive, you know, where we're always after the best and the most and the highest.
It's kind of anti-business model, isn't it?
Yes. And, and you know, Jesus says, no, you're blessed if you're poor. You know, you're blessed if you're grieving, you know, because you've got me, you know. So very passionate about it. I'd love to reinvigorate. If anyone's listening and wants me to come to their church, I'd love to come.
That's great. And they can get a hold of you at
TheBeatitudesProject.com. Okay. And there's ways of being in touch on there. My email address is probably out there in the ether somewhere. So.
Yeah. And and of course Google's so helpful. Just type in Stu G and you're gonna be there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So where do you go from here? I know of course the Beatitudes project is huge for you, but where do you see yourself going from here? And
I love music. Music's my passion. You know, I've got a studio at home, you know, I love collaborating with people. Something that I've done in the last couple of years is that I've got into a little bit of mentoring or consulting. Mm-hmm. Like I helped a church worship team in Raleigh, and I absolutely love doing that. So I don't know. I'd love to do more of that.
Yeah.
I want to stay playing. I'm really passionate about the Beatitudes project. Would love to keep sharing that. I got to, do the pitch for Compassion on a tour this spring, which I really love.
Yeah. Whose tour?
Michael W.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So, I really enjoyed doing that. I love, you know, the opportunity to share something and make people think, especially in this, you know, crazy divided moment that we're in,
mm-hmm.
You know, where everything is right and left. And I love like offering a different way of looking at the world, you know, and obviously that's inspired by the Beatitudes for me, but I just hope to continue, and I hope that I can also be a blessing to people as we go on. But you know, I'm here and ready to collaborate, honestly. You know, I don't want to stop yet.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. And if you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.